Here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
People always tell me, you should have your money working for you. Because you send your money out there working for you, a lot of times it gets fired. You go back there, what happened? I had my money, it was here, it was working for me. Yeah, I remember your money. We had to let him go.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Super Terrific Happy Hour. And joining me, as always, in this particular hour is the Super Terrific Happy Stephanie Palmer. Are you super terrific and happy this week?
I am especially happy to be joining you today. So, yes.
Excellent. How are you? Now, I've seen you in Florida wearing a sweater. So what is going on down there?
I'm a real Floridian. Just in the 3 years I've gotten here, I've gotten to the point where if it's below 70 degrees, I'm in a sweater. And the last time you saw me, I was in a turtleneck because it was 65.
Oh my God. 65 degrees. Bliss.
I'm gonna have to turn the fireplace on next week.
Careful now. You know that costs money. Heating's not cheap, Steph, even though inflation is low. Hey, so we have one topic and one topic only at hand today, and it's a topic dear to both our hearts, and that is gold. And we have a very special guest joining us, don't we?
The one and only John Hathaway of Sprott, a firm that is pretty much synonymous with gold and the precious metal space. So this should be a really great conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
Was John our guest on like the third episode of the Super Terrific Happy Hour? I think way back at the very beginning. He was one of our first guests, I'm sure.
He's been with us a couple of times now, I think.
Yeah, I seem to think he may have been our very first guest I think we had. It was either him or Bob Rodriguez. I can't remember, but one of the two of them was our very first guest. So it's a great thrill to welcome John back. What do you say we bring John in and have a chat with him?
Let's do that.
John, welcome back to the Super Terrific Happy Hour. You know, Steph and I are so excited to have a chance to talk with one of America's leading Bitcoin experts about the asset that everybody is clamoring for at the moment. So thanks for joining us.
No, it's very exciting to be back. Thank you.
Steph and I we beat ourselves up about gold the whole time. It's something that we're both big fans of. And so it's nice to get a chance to talk to a practitioner in the space who spends all of his time looking at gold miners and gold mining companies and get a sense of what's going on. Because, Steph, I don't know about you, but I have no idea. Do you?
Oh, my God. And every time I think I've figured it out, I am reminded by the markets that I have absolutely no clue whatsoever. So I'm looking forward to picking your brain, John, or at a minimum, having a nice, rigorous hand-holding session.
Right. This comes under the category of psychiatric aid.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. The check is in the mail.
Group therapy session. So, John, let's get a sense of where you see the broad picture for gold right now. Obviously, we had that crazy spike through the all-time highs when everyone was foaming at the mouth and jumping out. And even by gold standards, that was short-lived. I think it lasted just long enough for Peter Schiff to tweet, "This is the beginning of a new bull run." Right. And before he hit send, it had already fallen.
So, that was a kiss of death.
Yeah. So just give us a sense of you're just a general sense of where we are in the gold market at the moment.
You know, the interesting thing is that even though we've had this crazy last week, more than 100-point swing, I think, in a day, $100 swing, we've made grudging progress. I mean, the average gold price year to date is up 7%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is nevertheless higher than it was last year. And that is without any help at all from people we know. It's mainly central banks. It's Asian buying. But ETFs, which are mainly GLD, but several others, have actually lost assets while gold has climbed to this record high. Hard to imagine why. And it's very incongruous. But I'm actually very encouraged. I mean, I would like gold to sort of settle around these prices, maybe chop around for a while longer. But I think all in all, it looks pretty darn good, especially without any help from Western investors.
Yeah, the money transfer from West to East, the gold transfer, continues apace. Actually, it doesn't continue apace. It's accelerating.
Yeah, it's central bank buying, and a lot of it is not disclosed, certainly in China. I forget what the numbers are, but they're higher than they were last year. And I met with a fellow from the World Gold Council when I was in New York last week, I guess, maybe 2 weeks ago, that what they report is half of what's actually being taken up.
What do you make of the fact that, as you said, you know, gold's made great progress this year against a backdrop of kind of sharply rising real rates, which was always believed to be the kind of death knell for gold. That was the thing that if you get rising real rates, then gold is going to struggle in that environment. You know, to me, the very fact that we've seen such a strong performance, you say for gold to be up 7-8% in the conditions we've seen, I would not have guessed that if you'd told me what real rates were going to be this year. So do you have any sense of what's causing that kind of unexpected strength? Normally we're scratching our heads about unexpected weakness, but to me it's a case of unexpected strength this year.
Unexpected and really unrecognized strength. I would just bring it back to the U.S. fiscal picture and high real rates. Again, you have to sort of take into confidence that those projections of future inflation are correct. And I've always questioned that. But let's say that high real rates are, 2% or so. And historically, that has been poison for gold. But I think the difference today, and you can see discontinuity between a lot of these relationships, so-called strong dollar, high real rates, high nominal interest rates, tight monetary policy, if you want to call it that, all have broken down. Gold versus tips, that relationship has broken down. And we're left to speculate as to why that is. But I think it is the market sniffing out the vulnerability of the U.S. from a fiscal point of view. And certainly if we have rates higher for longer, if you believe that nonsense, it is very troubling for the U.S. fiscal picture. So let's see how that plays out. But part of the answer, and this is kind of rambling, but maybe gold is sniffing out a sharp drop in rates across the board. Maybe we are not going to have a soft landing. You know, Stephanie's been on that case for a while, and I'm certainly in agreement with it. And troubling bankruptcies, rising unemployment, all the things that would go with that. That's not in the markets, but I think gold might be sniffing that out.
You know, it does seem to your point that there is this angst that's evident beneath the surface. And you see that, obviously, aside from the fact that you have this shift in demand from global central banks, especially in Asia, but you also here have physical demand from retail buyers. You know, I read some article about Costco. I didn't even know they sold gold, but they couldn't keep it in stock because it was going so fast. So there is some sense among the retail community, maybe not it reflected in the ETF flows, but the guy on the street is actually starting to buy gold now.
Some, but compare this to 2011 when gold made its previous peak around 1900. The buying in gold ETFs, I think the tonnage AUMs went from 1400 to 2800. So that's over 2 or 3 years. And in this last year, we've seen a decline of a couple hundred tons, which is, you know, of course, the base is bigger today, but that's around a 10 or 11% decline. So while there are some folks that pay attention to you and people like you, and who are legitimately concerned about the viability of the currency, I think they're in a vast minority. And it's nothing like what you saw 10 years ago, 11 years ago. So I think that is still ahead of us. First of all, people get excited about the fact that gold is trading at $2,000. But if you inflation adjust that, it's probably 1,500 or 1,600. So it's, to me, it's not a big deal. And it would not be a big deal to see Western buying activated by some of the events we're all speculating about. And for another 1,000 tons or, you know, 50% more in terms of AUMs for these gold ETFs. And I think that would definitely take us to well north of where we are today and possibly 50% more.
There's a tendency for those of us who have an affinity for gold to, it could easily be two old men and a young woman here shouting at clouds on this podcast. But, you know, what you said there is interesting because this idea that the US fiscal situation matters to gold all of a sudden, you know, I think things like that, things like the math actually mattering was always a big part of the bull case for gold. It was a case of if you look at the numbers, none of this adds up. And it will ultimately affect the purchasing power of the dollar. It will ultimately affect the U.S. finances. It's also going to affect interest rates, confidence in the dollar, all these things. And for the longest time now, we've just not had any semblance of recognition on the part of market participants that any of this stuff matters. And I'm inclined to agree with you that I think the US fiscal situation is starting to kind of weigh on people's minds. And if we look at the CBO projections, that fiscal situation is going to get much worse and it's going to stay bad for some considerable, I mean, as far as they're projecting out, that line just keeps going up and to the right. If that is the case, if these things are finally starting to matter to the gold price and to people that look at gold as a kind of safe harbor from this, that suggests to me that we have potentially a kind of multi-year bull market. It may not be a raging bull market, but we at least have some kind of floor beneath the gold price that gold can build off in the next couple of years.
I agree. And you're seeing more and more even mainstream commentary on this subject. I can't recall specific voices here, but I mean, it's not just the sort of...
you can say it, lunatic fringe like me.
Yeah, the words fail me. No, you're hearing it from more middle of the road type of commentators. And I think that's a big change from where we were a few years ago. I mean, it's pretty obvious where we are. I mean, the other day, one of my colleagues mentioned that the interest on national debt is now higher than defense. If we have a recession, like I believe and Stephanie believes, what happens to the deficit, especially in an election year? And then you get this whole thing. You look at the Treasury auctions. I mean, the lack of enthusiasm is breathtaking. So I think the moment is here that these concerns, which have been talked about till I'm blue in the face, and maybe Stephanie and a few others, are finally starting to hit home. And a direct beneficiary of that, and getting back to your question, Grant, on real interest rates, that's why these relationships have broken down, in my opinion.
Is the catalyst going to have to be a crisis, a financial crisis or an economic crisis to really seal the deal for gold and not have us churning up and down $100 a day? You know, every time it looks like we're going to break out, then it gets slammed back down on some nonsense economic data. You know, we need something bigger to actually get this move that Grant was talking about really in motion? Or do you think it's just a steady grind as it has been for the last two decades?
It has been a steady grind, and there will be a recognition moment where all these people that are mainstream investors that are invested in NVIDIA, AI and all that kind of thing will start to pay attention. And they'll only start to pay attention when they see their accounts decline in value. So I think that's part of the recognition. And one of the things that could happen in a recession, and I've seen many people speculate about this, is that long rates could actually rise. The proposition that owning bonds in an economic slowdown has already been severely questioned, and certainly based on this year's and last year's performance of bonds in the face of a slowing economy, has been very disappointing to those proponents. Those of us who live this dream every day, dream or nightmare, whatever you want to call it, we look too closely, at all the jiggles on the screen. But if you take a step or two back, I think we've seen a lot of progress in the gold price, which is unrecognized. A lot of people are not there. The fact that gold has performed as well as the S&P for the last 25 years, I wonder how many people actually know that. I wonder how many people know that relative to the index without income, it's done twice as well over 25 years. The awareness is not there. So what we need is things that will create recognition. And again, I'm seeing more and more commentary from responsible, level-headed types, not people like us, that are talking about this issue that Grant has brought up. The fiscal issue is, I don't see how it goes away. The only way it goes away is a crisis. I don't see a crisis happening without gold not being, let's say, 50% to twice as much as where it is today. How that all plays out, that's a matter of guesswork. But I think that's ahead of us. And we have to fix entitlements. There's a long list of what has to be fixed, political process, you name it. But that doesn't happen without a crisis. And a crisis doesn't happen without gold doubling.
No, I watch that gold-copper ratio because that's generally a good sort of canary in the coal mine, as it were, of potential financial crises, and that's been creeping up as well. But it's ironic, John, as you describe this untenable fiscal situation and how clearly people are starting to wake up to that, that policymakers in the U.S. are still fast asleep. And yet all around the world, central banks have figured out our problem and are anticipating it and taking the necessary precautions to protect what they had in dollar assets by shifting that from treasuries into gold. At some point, do U.S. policymakers wake up? Or I mean, do you think they're really just going to have to get smacked in the face with some really nasty issue, whether it be economic or financial, before they realize they've already pushed this?
I think the latter. I think you're right. I mean, they'll be smacked in the face, kicking and screaming. And of course, one of the symptoms of this is that we're not seeing recycling trade surpluses into U.S. treasuries. Again, I think that's why you see these very lackluster auctions, especially on the long end. And I think it's amusing that the Treasury is now participating. I'm not sure quite how to figure that out, but they're buying $10 billion a month of newly issued treasuries to so-called stabilize the market. But as our friend Jim Grant points out, the Treasury has to borrow to buy. So they're only making the problem worse. It's almost getting comical. But you're right. Outside the U.S., they figured out ways. Trade partners look carefully at what's going on in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. They are starting to trade away from the U.S. dollar. And they have a surplus of RMB. They exchange that for gold.
Yeah, John, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the other things that I wanted to talk to you about. Because when we look at the fiscal situation, when we look at the numbers around gold, it's very easy to quantify. You can see what's happening. You can see the deterioration in the United States finance. You can see the projections of how bad they're going to be. You can see numbers like the interest expense, coverage costs versus defense spending. All that stuff is in plain view. And whether people decide it matters or not, it's just one of those things. At some point, it's going to, I keep saying it doesn't matter to anybody until it matters to everybody, and then it's going to matter a great deal. But when you talk about the Middle East and you talk about this idea of not recycling trade surpluses into treasuries, you know, this is the kind of unseen piece, and this is the piece that people are very reluctant to believe in, because what it means is an enormous geopolitical power shift away from an age of American hegemony, which is really all any of us have experienced, and into this bipolar world that people have been talking about now for, you know, a decade that it was coming. And when I saw MBS greeting Putin, you know, with basically as close to a high five amongst, you know, world leaders as you can get.
I don't know if a Russian knows how to high five.
Yeah, right. And plus, he'd have to count his fingers after high-fiving Putin. But to see that and the contrast with how Biden was greeted a few months prior, it's very clear to me that let's use the BRICS bloc just as an all-encompassing way to describe them. But you know, you have here a natural group of trading partners who have supply and demand of every vital commodity in the world. Yes, they don't have the spending power that the United States has on a per capita basis, but there's a couple of billion people in that part of the world that more than make up for the 350 million in the US potential customers. And this shift is taking place in plain view. But people aren't, it doesn't seem to me, are joining the dots. They're not looking at the coming together of the Saudis, the Russians, the Turks, the Iranians, all those people in that part of the world. And they're not looking at that through the lens of what's happening in the treasury market, what's happening with, you know, Russia selling all their treasuries, the Saudis selling theirs, even the Japanese selling theirs down. There's a definite shift here. What do you make of that? And what do you think it potentially means, not just for the gold price, but for the geopolitical stability of the world? It's a very long question, sorry.
No, that's fine, because I tend to give long answers.
Perfect.
I mean, to me, the implications are there's an increasing issuance of U.S. treasuries, deficits, higher interest rates, lower tax collections, all of that, and Fed divesting, at least for now. And the pool to absorb that has always been the petrodollar. And that's no longer available. We're not saying here that nobody's going to invest outside of the U.S. in treasuries. Some still will. And again, they'll have to find a suitable market rate, which the Fed and the Treasury are doing their best to prevent from that discovery. But at some point, there will be a market for our paper. But you have a shrinking source of demand because of the things we've just talked about, and an increasing supply because of QT and growing deficits. and the numbers just don't add up. So what does that mean? I mean, it certainly is potentially destabilizing for financial markets in general. The U.S. credit has always been the cornerstone of leverage. Short-term treasuries, you know, a lot of this plumbing that I frankly don't understand. Plenty of smart guys like Zoltan Pozsar who could explain it in 2 minutes, and I would get lost. But still, the basis of leverage is the U.S. dollar and particularly U.S. credit. And if that is threatened, I watched the MOVE index, M-O-V-E, which is volatility of the bond market. And a lot of people have talked about this too. If that doesn't settle down, then the implications to your question, Grant, are very dire for, I think, valuations across the financial markets.
That legendarily deep and liquid U.S. Treasury market is deep, but it's proving to be a lot less liquid than it was. And it's actually something that the Federal Reserve is very keenly, in theory, focused on, because in all their financial stability reports, they reference, you know, concerns about potential turmoil in the Treasury market. And I know Tom Hennig, who you know well, is constantly talking about that as a consequence, quite probably, of this reduction of the balance sheet. But related to that, you know, one thing that's fascinating, and we talked about the transfer from West to East as they diversify out of dollars into gold, et cetera, and the BRICS and their role in that and the petrodollar. But there's another interesting sort of new dynamic, possibly, and that is the Japanese. They used to be a steady audience for our paper. Clearly, the central bank isn't anymore, but they're also engaging in a potential shift for the first time in 3 decades in their monetary policy, where suddenly they're going to encourage higher interest rates in Japan, which makes, you know, U.S. Treasuries by comparison less appealing to a whole other. So does that factor in there? I mean, do you have a, I know it's a kind of off the beaten path, but do you have a view on Japan, or what do you think the BOJ is going to do? Or,
well, no, I pay attention, but I certainly,
you're too smart to forecast the BOJ.
No, but I think you just throw that into the whole mix of what we talked about. Just less demand for U.S. Treasuries, supply growing and historic demand shrinking. Sounds like longer term rates should be a lot higher than where they are today.
Either that or the Fed's balance sheet needs to be substantially bigger than it
or
is
the
today.
The Fed balance sheet needs to be substantially larger.
I was talking to Jesper Kohl about this literally yesterday or the day before, and he was, you know, he's been in Japan since the mid-80s, and he's very well connected over there. And his forecast for this time next year is that the Bank of Japan's policy rate will be 50 basis points. And if you think about that in real number terms, it shouldn't make much of a difference. But to go from negative 10 basis points to positive 50 after, as Steph says, you know, basically 20 years of zero or negative rates, is a massive change. And his point was that in March, all the pension funds settle on the rate on what is essentially like a money market pension fund. And he thinks that that will settle around 1%. And with the JGB yield now being allowed to float up to 1%, and he said, you know, they've taken the hard cap off now. It's a reference rate so that they're not wedded to this 1% level. But what that does, it allows the pension funds, with a quiet word from the Ministry of Finance, to match their liabilities through JGBs, which will take an awful lot of the heavy lifting away from the Bank of Japan. So, you know, whisper it quietly, but there is a way in which perhaps the Bank of Japan can ease their way out of this somehow. I still don't quite think they're going to be able to do it, but at least Jesper's kind of shown me a path. And that really would mean a dramatic change in capital flows when, if the biggest creditor nation in the world starts repatriating capital. The place that that's most likely to affect is the US. And one would imagine it would affect
margin,
it in a big
it seems
way.
Like, it seems very important at the margin. Again, with issuance going up, and we haven't even talked about what this all means, you know, and if Stephanie's been on this case for quite a while, for the trillions of low-grade debt that has to be refinanced. So the ripple effect of all of this seems to me potentially destabilizing, and destabilization of the regular order of things is generally positive for gold.
Can we talk a little bit about the miners? Because obviously this is your stock in trade. This is your stock in trade. And
I was wondering.
I have to say that for someone that invests in gold mining companies, you look a lot younger than I thought you would, because to have done this as long as you do and not look like, you know.
I have a good makeup artist.
No visible facial tics or anything like that.
It's truly extraordinary. It's like you're like the guy who's been punched in the stomach every day for 30 years, and yet you're still standing there smiling. So let's talk a little bit about the mining companies, the flows, the state of the market. Just give us an overall picture of that, and then we can kind of dig into some of the details.
Well, if you thought gold was out of favor, you haven't seen anything until it comes to mining stocks. I mean, there is absolutely no interest. There's no interest in gold. There's less interest in gold mining stocks. And just the big picture kind of number, the gold price since 2011 is up 23% since 2011. And the GDX is down 43%. Does that tell you something?
Even with this recent, 15% move we've seen in the stocks over the last few months, the gold miners relative to the price of the bullion is just scraping the bottom of the barrel, like barely saucering.
Yeah, just some other numbers. I mean, I just looked at one of the sell side valuation sheets across the board for the industry, and free cash flow yields are 13 to 19% at current gold prices. And the price to cash flow is 4.9, and the dividend yield is 2.6. So this industry, which has a well-deserved reputation for clueless financial management, is actually in really good shape. God forbid the gold price goes up anything like we're talking about. Those numbers are going to seem ridiculous. So I feel like if you're convicted on some of these sort of macro themes, as I am, that you're bang for the buck, you're really sort of stepping out to the edge here. But, you know, owning a bunch of these names that have these kinds of crazy cheap yields and valuation metrics seems to me like it's got the potential for 5 to 10 bagger type returns.
I can throw out a couple numbers for you because I was just looking up the total market cap of the XAU miners, $245 billion. Home Depot's market cap, $330 billion. But this begs the question, because it's one I get a lot when I travel around and I meet with the long-only sort of mutual fund complexes, and I have some people who have willing ears to hear this macro case for gold, and they're soft to it. But they then turn to me and they say, you know, it's too bad we can't do anything with this because the space is uninvestable. At $245 billion, you know, if you run a fund at Fidelity or, you know, Putnam or one of these firms, you have to have such an enormous position.
That's a valid point. On the other hand, to me, translates into spectacular returns because eventually they'll find a way.
But there are no heroes in that industry anymore, apparently. So,
you know, there are actually some smart people, entrepreneurial, that actually own stock in their companies and are doing some smart things. I mean, this is a great time to make acquisitions, and you're seeing some of that. So again, it's not for the indexers or for the large institutions, but for family offices, smaller hedge funds, let's say, creative thinking investors. I mean, it's a terrific thing to look at right now.
John, what about the juniors versus the majors? How are the two groups looking? Because obviously the juniors are always incredibly difficult to invest in, even for pros like you, because they're just so volatile. Have you seen any kind of shifts in either the volatility or the relative value between the two groups?
The good news is that you don't need to go to the juniors, which are largely, a lot of them are terribly illiquid, and very often they're just promotions. So, you know, you don't have to take that kind of risk when you have companies that are trading at 4 and 5 times EBITDA and generating free cash flow and actually earning. I think this is a time when, from a strategy point of view, I would invest, and we do, invest in companies that are producing in safe jurisdictions, which of course eliminates about 70% of the face of the globe. To your point, Stephanie, even though if it's uninvestable, just think about the illiquidity relative to the potential inflows for miners who are primarily in North America, Australia, and that's it. So, again, that's why I think you have this potential explosion in a lot of, you know, we have to have these changes in the way people see gold, but it won't take a lot of inflows to see tremendous returns in these kinds of stocks that are in safe jurisdictions are generating positive cash flow and actually have intelligent management. I mean, there's a list. It's not a huge list, but that's where I think the sweet spot would be. Again, you have to sort of agree with the macro premise, but now's the time to back up the truck on these kinds of names.
Well, I'm sold.
You were pre-sold.
But seriously, I think that, you know, it seems like my approach to this, John, and you have to advise me on it, has been that you first wanted to be long the bullion. And then as the bullion started to really move, you want to get long the miners because they're going to get leverage. And then eventually when that move happens that you're talking about where people realize we got to get into the space and it goes from being uninvestable to investable and in the process quintuples or whatever happens, you really then want to move to the junior miners and keep moving further and further down the sort of leverage pyramid.
Right. Yeah, that's in terms of gold price, we're, you know, $1,000 away from that. So that'll happen with $3,000 gold. But in the meantime, I'm going to be having so much fun. Maybe I'll camp out next to Grant down there in the Caymans.
I love it.
I just love the idea of someone having fun investing in gold miners. That's a sentence that I don't think it's ever been spoken before.
What did the miners do? Refresh my memory because I'm so beaten down. In the lead up to the global financial crisis, they must have doubled for sure, I would think.
They were great. From 2000 to 2007, there was a big move. And then, of course, everything cratered because of that. But then out of the box, again, these are numbers I just don't have on the top of my head. There was another huge run.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at this here, John. So from the summer of 2005, basically when they started to burst the housing bubble, it looks like the XAU went from 80 to 200 by March of 2008.
So and that had a lot of large cap names.
And then it got slammed back down for a couple months and then basically did that same thing all over again from this time 90 to 230. So more than double.
Yes. I look more at GDX and I'm not sure that GDX even existed back in those days. But yeah, you could see GDX, which is, again, is heavily weighted to large cap stocks, which is trading now around, call it 30, could easily triple. And that's the big cap. That's, you know, heavy weighting to Newmont. And a lot of these companies have lost their soul. You know, they're diversifying into copper, which again is if you're a contrarian, you've got to love it. But, you know, they'll become investable for, you know, the Black Rocks and the Fidelities and so forth. But, you know, for those who want to do the homework and look at the smaller single asset companies or just a handful of assets in good jurisdictions, I mean, a triple in GDX could be a 10 bagger in some of these other names.
What could be the reason in 6 months that the three of us are sitting here crying in our cups of soup? You know, there's always something that the gold miners have this habit of finding new and creative ways of letting you down. Is there anything out there that you sit there and think, you know, this is something on my radar screen, this is something I need to pay attention to, because if this doesn't happen or this does happen, then it's gonna impact us negatively?
Well, one thing you have to be careful about, or certainly be wary of, is a market meltdown like we had in 2007, 2008. That'll take everything with it. Gold went down. Stephanie, I remember your dad and I were high-fiving when Bear Stearns went out of business and gold ticked at 1,000. And then the next 6 months, we were all saying, oh my God, this is just terrible, because it went down to 600, I think. So yeah, I think a market meltdown, which ultimately is very good for this strategy, could be painful. So that would be one thing. And maybe the main thing I would worry about.
Deleveraging across the board.
Just wholesale deflation, credit deflation, which I definitely think is in the cards. So I guess the counter to what I just said, I guess, would be that the stocks are already ridiculously inexpensive. So, you know, maybe you just have some pain, but not equivalent to what the NVIDIA folks will be experiencing. I love Grant smiling on that.
The cat that swallowed the canary.
Yeah, no, for sure. Funny enough, this week I was just going back through the gold price, back through, you know, the Great Depression and looking at what happened there in this massive bout of deflation. And obviously it was different because the price was fixed at $2,067 an ounce, but it, you know, it did fluctuate a little bit around that depending on the pressures at the time. And it dropped in 1931 to $17, which is, you know, 15% fall in the gold price, even against the fixed peg. But the interesting thing was the purchasing power pickup you had, even though gold fell, based on what the stock market did. And this is the kind of the component of this that I think people don't think about. When you go back to Bear Stearns in 08 and that rush to 1,000 before gold fell, you know, 20-odd percent or whatever it was after that, and everyone's saying, well, gold's supposed to go up in a crisis, not down. But if you look at it in units of the S&P you could buy, the purchasing power of gold doubled, even though the liquidity concerns meant that people sold it to raise capital. It's the purchasing power that's so important. That there's not, you know, everyone gets fixated on talking about the price. In the Great Depression, yes, you had the advantage of gold being fixed, but obviously, as soon as they came out of the Great Depression, we saw which way the pressure was on the gold price. It was to go up because Roosevelt had to move it up. But you picked up four times your purchasing power during that period in terms of gold versus
stock
market.
I'm glad you brought that up, because margins, you know, if it's a 30s sort of repeat, that might be different. But we know that we can see that the rate of inflation has slowed. And the miners, and I should have mentioned this earlier, are even in a flat gold price environment, or maybe a decline in maybe an 07 kind of scenario, their earning power will go up in real terms. And that's something that nobody pays attention to. I've seen a couple of old timers, even more old timer than me, bring that point up because maybe they remember the 30s. But that's a very important point, that price stability on the cost side. We don't need $3,000 gold to make an argument for miners, because they'll be the only ones around that benefit from a credit deflation.
There's also one sort of difference between analyzing today and then, and that is we now have this complete bifurcation in the gold market. We have a paper market and we have a physical market. And it would seem to me that if we had a repeat of the 1930s, that physical market, I could see where on my Bloomberg screen, gold may go down alongside the S&P and risk assets in general in this wholesale liquidation. But if I go to the guy on the corner and say, hey, I've got a bar of gold, what do you give me for it? I would think that price would still be much higher and maintain its value. But maybe I'm just drinking my own Kool-Aid here. It seems like we definitely have two different prices for the gold market.
The New York price is algos. They play these games when the gold price shot up to, was it 21 something? They just load up on the short side. I mean, it was a bear trap in the first place for gold to go from below 1900 up to 2100, because everybody was short, hugely negatives. And these algos just, you know, how do they get short? Do they actually go to the bank and take out a cup? You know, no, they get credit from another bank. I'm shorting, you know, 1 million ounces of gold. Oh, you've got it. Okay, you're good. That's the trade. I mean, there's no gold changing hands. So if you look at the Bloomberg numbers and then you look at the Shanghai numbers, there's a premium. Lately, it's sort of 3% or so, you know, which is in dollars, it's a lot. But that's the real price to me. But again, you know, nobody looks at it that way. But there is this paper market, which is more and more just a gambling casino. And then there's the real market. And so your proverbial guy on the corner might give you a lot more than the Bloomberg price just to have the security of a kilo.
Well, this is probably purely a rhetorical question because I sure as hell don't know the answer to it, but I'll ask you anyway. It seems to me like that Sunday night that you referenced when we were all watching the gold price go up to 21,000, it was up $50 or something, and we're getting super excited. And of course, wake up the next morning and it was getting smashed. And it kind of spoke to me of this difference between the East and the West and the Shanghai gold price and what we see here, in that there's real physical demand there. And so Sunday night, you know, they're actively buying. And then, you know, when the Western traders come in, they smash it. And I just wonder, at what point do people figure out that they're fighting an uptrend? Wouldn't there be more money to be made to get on the other side of this and to, you know, just ride the rising tide?
When you're talking about algos and, you know, program traders and CTAs and all of that, that's a small percentage of the investable assets. I don't know what the AUMs, you know, one of our guys does that, you know, there's a number, but, you know, relative to the investment universe, it's tiny. I think we did something, a study a while back where, you know, less than 1% of the global investable assets, I guess you add up pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and so forth, less than 1% is in gold at all. So these wild gyrations that are caused by banks trading against each other, maybe some hedge funds, just trying to pick off stops, run shorts, and then pick off longs. It's a sideshow in the ultimate universe of what we're talking about, because what we're talking about is big shifts geopolitically, big shifts in the value of major currencies relative to each other and maybe and relative to gold. That's a much bigger deal than just these games that are being played that sort of capture the headlines on a day-to-day basis.
Now I know how you stay sane.
Well, yeah.
Tell me.
Well, John, I was just going to say, before we close, I was actually going to ask you for some advice for people who are looking to trade, particularly the stocks, because you are one of the few people that's done this and not been carried out on a stretcher. And I think whatever advice you can give people in terms of just, I think most of it's mindset, really. There's a way to look at this and a way to think about it and a way to position that at least gives you the latitude to be patient. On the one hand, you don't want to miss the chance of the kind of gains that the gold market can offer you. But on the other side, there are so many head fakes in this thing. How do you think about that? How do you think about managing the mental side of this?
The mental side.
Yeah, and you're not allowed to use the word padded or sell.
I think you have to have conviction in a lot of what we've talked about, and you have to be willing to be a contrarian, which some people just can never do. And, you know, position intelligently. I mean, you can't overload this exposure, and it should be sort of a tactical or maybe core, depending on your point of view. And again, you know, trying to trade it, I think, is a loser's game. You just have to be, what was it Jesse Livermore said? Get right and sit tight. So there has to be some element of that in this whole thing. I mean, if you pay too much attention to the day-to-day fluctuations, you'll go crazy. And of course, you know, I do pay attention, but, you know, I'm paid to do it. But, you know, I think most people should just come to and say, there's an investment case to be made for a much higher gold price. Gold is incorrectly priced at $2,000 and the reasons why. And if that's the case, and if I'm on board with that, how can I maximize the return from that point of view? And then you would look at an active manager like our firm, or you might do the work yourself, which you can certainly do, and own these stocks that are trading at 5 and 6 times earnings per share and these free cash flow. You have to be a value buyer, and you have to sort of be, it's the inverse of NVIDIA. As we both, all three of us know, individual stock picking has gone by the boards. It's a lost, I'll still call it an art. Very little of the money that's managed today, and I saw an interview Felix Zuloff gave with Ted Oakley. Stephanie, you met him at Dixon. It's very good. I can send it to both of you. Like, it's 70 or 80% of the AUMs in the world today are managed by programs and by FAs who don't, they just answer phones. They don't think. And they're told by their firms, whatever, Morgan Stanley and Bessemer and what have you, just to, you know, do this much for value, do this much for growth, blah, blah, blah. It's just, that's all that happens. I like to think that for those of us who actually do the work and have these convictions about what's mispriced and what's overpriced, that there is a huge return to be made by standing pat with this point of view. And this moment in time is to be able to buy this exposure, this out of favor, where you can make the investment case for a much higher stream of cash flow and earnings because of the gold price. I don't think you're going to see this opportunity last forever. And again, we're just speculating on when that's going to change. But I am very comfortable owning what I consider to be great value with a potential change in the environment that will create returns of 10x on those assets.
Couldn't have put it better myself. Steph?
I'm sorry, I was busy adding to my gold position. You got me so amped up.
Before we go, my granddaughter, 5 years old, was rummaging around my desk in my office where I'm sitting. And these mining companies will give you these, I think they're probably plated gold coins, you know, commemorating a certain mine opening or whatever. And she found one. She said, "Grandpa, does this have chocolate inside?"
Oh, that's a That's a girl after my own heart.
Did you tell her it'd be worth more if it did?
the utility of the metal is suspect.
John, do you want to? You mentioned in passing your firm and what you do. Do you want to give a little sales pitch and tell people about you? Write a commentary that is that available to the public? I know I have the pleasure of seeing it, but is that something they post on the website?
I write quarterly on the Sprott website, and they scrub it and then they post it. So I get to say 90% of what I think.
Well, I'll see if I can finagle my way to get into that. I want to find out what the 10% is.
Yeah, I can't remember that, but it just look up Sprott Inc. and then you navigate your way through the site. And I think it's under commentaries of some sort, doing a terrible job of steering any potential.
Don't worry, I will find it and put a link to it in the transcript so people will be able to people will be able to find it and click on it. That's too easy.
Well, thank you so much for doing
this,
John.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. I can see why you call it the super terrific happy hour.
Yeah, it's not necessarily always the case when we're talking about gold. Sometimes it's the miserable, depressed, sad hour, but we get through it, don't we, Steph?
We absolutely do. I love it.
All right, John. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Okay. Lovely to see you.
Take care.
All right, see you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As I said, I'm not sure if it is group therapy talking to John about gold for you and I, but, it's funny. There are so many periods in the cycle of gold where things just kind of line up and make sense. And I struggle to think of a period in the last, certainly since that run-up in 2011, so the last 12 years, maybe the end of 2015, things lined up pretty well, and we had a really good run for the first 6 months of 2016. But I struggle to think of a better setup for gold than we've got right now.
Yeah, no, I agree. And actually, even during those periods, perhaps right after the global financial crisis, was most similar to today in terms of, what we're seeing globally, not just here domestically. But it does seem to me that the setup is just so phenomenal. And I am glad to have this conversation with other people, because sometimes I think I just can't perceive a scenario that isn't bullish for gold. Whether you believe in the hard landing or whether you think we escape with no landing, and pursue each one to its natural conclusion. And it seems like all roads lead to gold. So I want to check myself and make sure that I haven't put the cart before the horse. So this is...
Well, it's funny because the point John made there, and I saw Ronnie Stoeffle in Switzerland just a few weeks ago, and he put up a great chart that showed that I think since 2000, gold's CAGR is basically 9%. And so when we talk about gold, people kind of expect it to just have these crazy years, and it, very occasionally it does. But at the end of the day, the point John made, I think, is such an important one. You could have owned gold from 2000 to now, outperform the S&P without that income component. And even with the income component, you've basically matched it with really very little stress. I mean, there's been, you had the excitement of 2011 followed by the fall, then it kind of went sideways and it's just ground higher. It's very kind of un-gold-like. People think of it as this wildly speculative asset, but it's been such a solid performer. In those 25 years, I think there's been two down years. And the rest of them have been either unchanged or just higher. And I think people forget that about gold.
Well, it's just not as interesting to talk about. So CNBC is not going to devote a whole day of programming to discussing gold. When you're talking about the S&P, there are so many things that you could get into there. So it sells. Gold, I guess I would say, is probably the least sexy asset out there and therefore doesn't command the kind of attention, even though, like you said, its performance has been great. And hopefully it's about to really surprise us all on the upside here.
What we need is CNBC to do a metal in turmoil sequence. Once we get the metal in turmoil sequence, we will know conclusively that things are on the up.
Oh, God, please. I don't think I have the intestinal fortitude to get through that.
Either that, or can we pay Cramer to tell people to sell it? That might be the other way forward. I don't know.
Maybe that. I'd prefer that. That's perfect.
All right. Our thanks to our guest, John Hathaway. You will find his work, if you go to the Sprott website and look for Sprott Insights, it's quite easy to find John's work there. And it's a fantastic read. If you're interested in the gold markets or God forbid you're invested in them, it's required reading as far as I'm concerned. Thanks to John, as I said, for joining us. And my thanks to you, Steph, as always, for being such a wonderful partner in crime. I will do you the, or save you the trouble of telling everybody where to find you on Twitter, because I know how much you hate that. You'll find Steph at S Pomboy, except no substitutes. There's plenty of fakers out there. It's at S Pomboy. And don't forget to go to macromavens.com as well and find out all the other stuff she does. And with that, Steph, I will wish you... Can we say Merry Christmas or do we have to say Happy Holidays? I forget.
What about you? You didn't give your handle and all of that.
Oh, God.
TTMYGH.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. TTMYGH. There we go. Can I wish you Happy Christmas, Merry Christmas, or do we have to say Happy Holidays? I'm not sure.
Well, when we're speaking to each other, I think that it's okay to say Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas. Or
you
whatever.
Know what? We could compromise. I wish you a joyous Festivus. How's that?
I wish you the best goddamn Christmas you could possibly have, all right? Yes, Merry Festivus.
All right, I will see you soon. Take care.
You too.
Nothing we discussed during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.